Assalamu alaikum. Good evening to everyone. I feel, can anyone see me? This feels like a really high lectern, but at least you can hear me, inshallah. If you can't hear me, raise your hand at the back. If you can hear me, raise your hand. Oh, that's good. That's great. Well, I'd like to thank Sister Huda for giving this nice overview of her reading of women and men's roles in the Quran and the Sunnah. And I'd like to look at things a little bit from a different perspective this evening, to try to put things in a bit of a comparative context, to identify some of the major areas for where we need to work a little harder, where we need to think about how to implement some of the ideals that we hold, some of the areas where we're doing better than others, some areas where we're not doing so well, and try to suggest some strategies for working together, or at least strategies for thinking a little more deeply about how to solve some of the inconsistencies that we see between our beliefs and our practice. First of all, I would begin as a Muslim by saying Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, the Merciful, the Compassionate. Alhamdulillah wa salatu wa salam ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in. Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah wa ashhadu anna Muhammadan abdu rasuluh. So I begin by praising God and by witnessing that Muhammad is His servant and messenger, and I begin by praising God to identify myself in this university first as a Muslim. And what I'm saying is that, the reason why I'm saying that is that I'm speaking to you from a religious framework. And that's something that I need to have a right to do, even when I'm speaking in an academic context. Now, that may seem obvious to you. To others, it may seem uncomfortable. Having studied my PhD at the University of Chicago, I know that many people believe that there is a neutral discourse that's stripped of religion, which is a secular discourse, and that's the proper discourse to use, speaking rationally, speaking about issues. I believe that neutrality is a fiction, and that people of faith should not have to reduce their language, strip their language always of God, and to somehow justify everything in materialistic terms. At the same time, Muslims need to realize that the goal of Islamic law, according to religious scholars, is not simply to get people to the afterlife. That's the ultimate goal. But how does that happen? That happens through a life process. And if our lives are not shaped in a way that is fair and just, if our experience in this life and in this society is not a positive experience, there's a very good chance that we will not become the kind of grateful people of faith who will feel that close relationship with God. In fact, if the society in which we live is unjust and unfair, and in particular, if the injustice is done in the name of religion, probably people will be driven away from religion. So that it is not in my hands if anyone gets into paradise. It's not in my hands if anyone is guided. But what is in my hands are the day-to-day things and the institutional things as a member of society to try to make this a fair, just, good society in which people will develop their natural tendency to be grateful, to recognize God, and that is what true faith is. It's gratitude, it's shukr. The Quran talks about it being thankfulness. The opposite, the word that means unbelief literally means being ungrateful. So Muslim scholars have always recognized that Islamic law has to be oriented around preserving five main goals. The first goal is to preserve religion, but the other things are life, property, family, and mind. And so that means that as Muslims, we have to be very concerned about the implementation of our ideals, whether it's working or not working. Because if it's not working, and there's a gap between our theory and our reality, then people are going to be turned away from religion. And that happens, and we won't have been fulfilling our goals. So the person who has faith is the one who is a realist, the one who has wide open eyes, looks at problems, acknowledges them, and tries to solve them, because that's our responsibility here on earth. Now, one of the things I want to talk about at first is just what some of the apparent problems with the application of Islamic law or Islamic morality to the lives of women. Talk about some of those apparent problems and see whether they really are or not. The first thing that I notice is that we have a real problem in communication between Muslims and non-Muslims often, or between observers of Islamic society and participants of Islamic society, because of the incredible emphasis put on visibility and visuality in modern society. And this is something that is really unprecedented, even in the West. Although the West has a long tradition of emphasizing visual knowledge of things. So, for example, we see that portraiture and Western art emphasizes the individual and portraying the individual in their image. So statues, paintings, and of course the three most popular subjects for portraiture are women, beautiful women, deities, so gods, religious pictures of Jesus and saints and people, other major Christian figures, and then political leaders. And so all of these things emphasize a different thing. The pictures, the religious pictures emphasize a certain view or image of God and God's place in the world. The pictures of women, you know, very rarely did you have pictures of women who were very well dressed. Usually it was women's sexuality, their voluptuousness, their sensuality. With men, it was their greatness and power. You know, Islam forbade the creation of any of these kinds of images. We were supposed to know God in a different way. We were supposed to know women. Men were supposed to know women in a different way. And we were supposed to relate to our leaders and the greatness of our leaders in a different way. And so I think that what happens is that we come to put an emphasis in the West on visuality and think that being seen means being known. Or seeing someone or seeing something, seeing that person, a depiction of that person means that you know them. So we see pictures of movie stars and famous people, and people have a sense, you know, in popular culture that they know that person. Whereas it's extremely superficial. What do we know about them? Islamic society looks at things differently, and you should know people by their actions and what they do. And I want to give you an example. I do not believe that covering the face is required in Islamic law, but there are people who believe that Islamic law requires women to cover their face. I lived in Pakistan for a year when I worked in an Afghan refugee camp, and because Afghan society is very conservative, especially among the kind of village people who were living in the camps, most women needed to cover their face and their whole bodies. Now, I remember one day, I remember hearing my husband, when I first met him, speaking about this one woman. Her name was Umm Muhammad. And he spoke about her so many times, about this great woman who was very smart. She was a scholar, about how smart she was and all the different things that she said. He was telling me about all the good work that she did, working with orphans and running these camps. And I didn't meet. She was covering her face, totally. And I realized that my husband had never seen her. And what was interesting to me was that he had such a complete picture of who this woman was. He had so much respect for her. yet he had never seen her. And that's something that I think is very difficult for people coming from a Western perspective to understand, because we think that being covered means being invisible. If you read newspapers and descriptions of, you know, the streets of Saudi Arabia or other places, the way that reporters will describe it, it's, you know, women are invisible. You never see women in the streets, or you never, you know, women are invisible in the society. In Muslims don't look at it that way. To be covered does not mean to be invisible, and to be uncovered does not mean that you are known. So I really want to stress that, because I think that's probably at the heart of a lot of the misunderstanding of the dynamics of an Islamic society and of a Muslim society. I also remember when we took a trip to Morocco, where I teach the Hartford Seminary, and we went to, it was an interfaith group, and one of the women in our group, who was a non-Muslim, was very upset, because she said, why do I just see men in the coffee shops and I never see women? And this is, you know, why are women stuck in their homes and why can't they come out and go into the coffee shops? And she thought that this was a really bad thing. Now, the man said, you know, he was very nice, this Moroccan man, and he said to her very gently, he said, you know, what happens is that when women's friends come over to visit, the men leave the house so the woman can have privacy with her friends. And usually, because culturally, the women are taking care of younger children, and so it's not as easy for them to go out and drag the kids everywhere to go sit in the coffee shop for a few hours. What happens is that the men, out of respect for their wives' privacy, so they can have... And these are people, ordinary people who live in small apartments, they don't have a lot of space, is that they leave and their wives are visiting with their friends. So, you know, I mean, you could analyze that in many different ways, but there's a basic dimension to the whole culture that is being engaged in that society that's not understood, because things are looked at very superficially, just visually from the picture on the street, and then assumptions are made. Because women aren't sitting in the cafes, they're not doing anything. Or because women are sitting in the cafes, that means they have no life, or they have no social life, or they're stuck at home, you know, just scrubbing the pots and pans. Whereas there may be a lot going on in those homes. There may be what happens, for example, traditionally over the centuries, in Muslim societies where women have study circles, things called halaqas, so that they're running study groups. They're having all sorts of activities, but it's not necessarily in the same space as the men. So we have to look at those things and understand them. Anyone who's honest has to say that there's a problem with the way societies deal with women's bodies and women's sexuality. That's true in any society, and every society has a different way of dealing with it. And the most important thing in having a productive conversation is to acknowledge the flaws or the problems in our own society. And I think sometimes when we're having a discourse and when we're talking about Muslim societies, we're really unfair and we aren't recognizing our own problems. Now, there was something very interesting that I read in the New York Times about 2 months ago. I don't know if anyone knows of this author. She's an Indian author. She wrote The God of Small Things. Her name is Arundhati Roy. She's of Hindu descent. I assume she's some kind of practicing Hindu based on her novel, which was about different Hindu practices. Beautiful novel. She's also a social activist. She's very well known in India for protesting against very destructive environmental policies of the Indian government. And she argues a lot for poor people. Now, there was a great feature on her in the New York Times, and they were talking... They mentioned that she used to have beautiful long hair, and that just before the interview she'd cut her hair to an inch short. And they asked her, why did she basically shave her head? She said, because I was so tired of reading articles about my book readings and interviews I had where they kept talking about my beautiful long hair. So I decided to cut it off. Now, that's a solution. That's one solution. Islam looks at things a little different. The way that Muslim women deal with this is that we say, you know, in public, we're going to wear a certain kind of professional dress that provides enough coverage that our hair does not get all of this excessive attention. And that's the basic difference between Muslim women's dress and Muslim man's dress, because the rest of it is, you know, basically the same, and it's covering up. You know, if you look at any Muslim society, the men and the women pretty much wear the same thing, but slightly different fabric or form. So in Saudi Arabia, they wear the long one-piece gown. In Pakistan, they wear shalwar kameez. So it's almost always pretty much the same thing, a little bit different cut, a little bit different fabric, maybe colors. But the women, Islamic dresses, the women also cover their hair completely. Now, you could say, well, that's not the solution. You know, either you should just cut your hair off, or sexuality should be totally neutralized, or there should be, you know, we shouldn't have any, that, you know, people shouldn't pay that much attention to women's hair. But that's something that could be discussed. It's not something that's decided, and the assumption that this is necessarily a sign of oppression is incorrect. You know, also, something happened 2 weeks ago that really shocked me. I don't know why, but Greta Van Susteren got a plastic surgery. I don't know, I'm coming from America, and even though I'm Canadian, I've lived in the United States for so long, I think sometimes I make the mistake that Americans make, which is that we think that everyone, you know, the world revolves around the United States, so you all know, you know, all these American people. But anyways, Greta is, she's a lawyer, an American lawyer who became very famous during the O.J. Simpson trial, analyzing the trial. And then she got a position on Court TV and then CNN, and then she moved over to Fox just recently. So I used to love watching her because, frankly, she was a rather plain woman. And but very smart, you know, very smart lawyer, analyzed the issues, and I just loved to see her. Now, before she moved to Fox, she went and had hundreds of thousands of dollars of plastic surgery on her face. She's totally transformed. She looks totally different. And she said, well, they didn't ask me to do it. And this is a woman who's about 50 years old. She said, they didn't ask me to do it, but I just wanted to prove to all those boys who wouldn't date me in high school that they were all wrong. Now, you know, what's interesting to me is this is a woman who I remember she was interviewing before the United States started bombing Afghanistan. She was talking with a woman about Afghani women. And the camera showed a picture of one of the new refugee camps that was budding up in Afghanistan because they knew that the Americans were going to bomb, so people were fleeing. And it showed there were a couple thousand Afghanis who were gathering in this, you know, bare area, nothing there. They're under tents, not even real tents, basically blankets with sticks. And it showed, the camera panned in on this woman who was sitting there under a blanket that was being held up by a little stick. She was rocking this baby who was crying, clearly hungry, cold, tired. The woman looked exhausted. And she had the traditional, very colorful Afghani clothes on, a kind of puffy dress with the wide pants, and then this loose scarf over her head. And Greta Van Susteren said, you know, they were talking about the women's dress, Afghani women's dress, and she said something like, well, I mean, look, this woman, she certainly looks oppressed. And what was amazing was she saw the scarf on her head as the sign of oppression. She didn't happen to notice the tent, the lack of water, the lack of housing, the lack of food. But then this is a woman who later, 2 months later, goes and gets hundreds of thousands of dollars of plastic surgery on her face. On your face. I mean, the face, which is such a sensitive, personal area, it's who you are. You know, what is different between that and covering your face? What is a society, you know, in New York City, studies have shown that something like 70% of Jewish girls who grow up in New York City get a nose job by the time they're 16 years old. You know, that's not to say, you know, what I'm saying is that there are problems in Muslim societies, but we also have problems here. And there's a pressure on women, and it's getting worse and worse. It starts at 16, it doesn't end when you're 50. And the constant bombardment of images of women over and over and over on the street, on signs, in magazines, on TV, makes people feel so unhappy with how they look. I mean, this doesn't have anything to do with the weight problem, Canadian women, if you took a poll right now, would say that they're unhappy with the shape of their body. And take that poll in a country that, you know, that doesn't have this affluence or doesn't have this culture of visuality. What percentage of women will you find being unhappy with their body shape? It'll be a huge difference. So, you know, we have to be aware of that. We have to be aware that there are serious problems with the image, with the way images are used in this society, and it's affecting women in a real way. It's causing them to mutilate themselves, to undergo surgery, to inject silicone in all sorts of places. I mean, to go under general anesthesia. I mean, think about it. I listened on public radio. Public radio in the United States is like CBC. So this is the one place where you can get intelligent conversation. A three-hour afternoon program that is hosted by a 50-year-old woman. She spent 3 hours talking about plastic surgery for women, about taking fat out of, you know, a certain place in the thigh and injecting it into the cheek to make you look younger. And I mean, it was from top to bottom. This is an intelligent solution to the image of women in society. You know, I don't want to dwell on it too much, but I'm a little bit frustrated having followed the news much more closely the past couple months than I normally do. You know, because of the situation since September 11th, I've watched a lot more TV, read a lot more newspapers, a lot more general interest publications, just because I felt that I need to be aware of sort of what the average person, the average American, and I live in America, you know, what they're reading. And it's just amazing to me how there are such superficial impressions of Islam and of Muslim women. And it's a problem because it affects policy. You know, it not only affects attitudes, but it goes down and it filters down and affects major policies. Now, this is not to say, and I want to move to my next section, that there are not problems in Muslim societies, or that women are not sometimes oppressed in the name of religion or in the name of Islam, because this happens. This happens often. I mean, anywhere there's someone who wants to commit violence or oppression, they will use the most powerful discourse that's around them. And in some areas, that will be a tribal discourse. So, for example, in many parts of Afghanistan, where the people, where religion, you know, seems to have penetrated very lightly, they will talk about the code of the Pashtuns, and they will use that to justify certain practices. So, for example, it's part of Pashtun practice that instead of a man giving a gift to his wife at the wedding, two fathers arrange to, you know, the one father says, well, I'll let your son marry my daughter, and your son will marry my daughter, and that's it. We'll just call it a deal. There's a term for this in Islamic law called shigar, and it's prohibited in Islamic law. But if you go to Afghanistan among those tribes, they'll say, no, well, this is our culture, this is our tradition. So they use their most powerful discourse, which is the discourse of their culture and their tribalism, to justify what they do to oppress some women in their society. In Muslim societies, you will find people using Islam as a justification for all kinds of oppression. That's absolutely true. But that doesn't mean that Islam is the cause, truly supports that oppression or supports those practices. One example, a very good example, are honor killings, which go on in particular in Jordan, Syria, Lebanon. That area in particular, there's a kind of tradition of honor killings. This is also prohibited in Islamic law. In Islamic law, if someone, you know, goes as a vigilante and murders someone out of some kind of justification, speculation, then they're considered a murderer and should have capital punishment. But for years this went on in places, and it was, unfortunately, there were even religious scholars who would justify it. Now, there's been a lot of work done on that over the past few decades, and these countries now have banned this, and they've agreed to crack down. But it took time, because there was a kind of reactionaryism among some of the religious classes, some of the religious communities, because, you know, so much was lost under colonialism. So much of Islamic law was lost. The colonialists came, they took away civil law, they took away criminal law, they took away the ability to govern the marketplace, they took away inheritance, they overthrew the foundations and the endowments, and they left this tiny little area of family law. And so the Muslims often became very reactionary about it, very defensive, and it became frozen in a way that it wasn't before. We could see, if we read the law books and the books of fatawa, which are the opinions of the jurists, how law is applied century to century, we see continued growth and interpretation and development, but then we see a kind of stagnation, a freezing, once colonialism sets in, and then in the post-independence period, because people are trying to hold on to something that they feel is slipping away. And then also, because the family is all that's left in sort of the purview of the religious community, they become more and more conservative about that area. So there's an unfortunate dynamic that set in place about many of these things. But I feel that's getting a lot better now. I mean, I think most societies are now beyond that and have been able to examine these things. And most Muslim scholars are aware of these problems and are trying to really deal with them in the proper way. One of the reasons that many of these societies are being forced to deal with these problems, frankly, though, is because women themselves have put these issues on the table. And Muslim women have been involved in societies from Pakistan to Egypt, all across the Muslim world, in really raising these issues and in going back into Islamic law and digging out the authentic sources and saying, you know, look, there are certain things in our society that are being done that are being justified in the name of religion, and they aren't. In fact, it's contradictory to religion, and our religion, our holy book, the Quran, the example of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, gave us rights. And we're not getting those rights. And sometimes there were very bad reactions, but often there were good reactions too. And I'm, you know, anyone who fairly looks at the development of scholarship towards women over the last 50 years will see that Muslim scholars have been listening to women and reinterpreting things to the benefit of women. And you know, we could look at some examples just in North America. You know, I remember going to Islamic Society of North America convention 15 years ago in Dayton, Ohio, and I remember at that point not only were there no women on the stage, but any woman who had a question had to write her question on a piece of paper and send it up to the front, because it was considered improper for a woman to even stand up in the audience and ask a question. But that was 15 years ago. It's not a lot of time. now, not that I in any way deserve it, it's a big responsibility, but the same organization elected me as their vice president, the head for all of the United States. So, you know, I mean, you see that there's this community and that is very responsive. And I'm proud to be associated with a community that is that responsive to the needs of their constituents, who are honest and open and who are ready to leave behind some very emotional attachments, some things that they grew up with culturally that make them uncomfortable. You know, many of them, I remember the first time I went to a board meeting at the Islamic school and I was the only woman. You know, it was so uncomfortable. These were 50-year-old men. And it was really uncomfortable for them at first, but they are the ones who invited me there. And it was very successful, alhamdulillah, thank God. So I give them a lot of benefit for dealing with that discomfort, because they realized that their discomfort was not based on something that was necessary or good in Islam, but that it was something that they had to learn to deal with, put behind certain things that they'd grown up with, socialized with. And we have very successful work, thank God, because of our ability to work together professionally and with integrity, God willing. So, you know, I think sometimes we're, you know, Muslims are the harshest on our own self. And we are impatient and we want to see change. But the change that, and the responsiveness in the Muslim community, I think, is very good. Now, that's in North America. There are other problems when we look at other areas. And part of the requirements or preconditions for change is that there's a certain stability in society. Because any society that feels it's under siege or under attack or insecure will start to be conservative, will start to be very suspicious of change. And unfortunately, this is what we see in many Muslim societies, simply because of the instability, because of the attacks from outside. And so, you know, we need to be able to figure out what the best way of dealing with that is. But let me just mention a few more examples of the development that the Muslim community has made in a place like North America, where we have the ability to develop our own governing organizations. We have the freedom to decide how we will organize ourselves as Muslims. You know, in most traditional Muslim countries now, there's a ministry of endowments and religious affairs, Wuzarat al-Awqaf wa Shu'un al-Islamiyya, and it's appointed by the government to oversee the religious schools and all of the instruction from the top down, even to appoint imams in mosques. Now, this is something that is really an effect of colonialism, because when the colonialists came, they wanted to subdue this whole realm of civil society that was these widespread religious endowments. And so they centralized them and took them over, and then the post-independence governments, which were nation states, then put these under the control of the national government. And that's why you see religious matters are so political in Muslim countries, because it is under the power of the government now, which was not true in pre-modern times. You know, it's interesting because people think there was no separation of so-called church and state or religion and state in medieval Islam, but in fact, there was a greater separation in the medieval period than there is now. But in the United States, we have the freedom to develop our own organizations, to debate, to discuss, to grow in the way we want. And in some of the areas where this has helped women a lot, because Muslim women have a choice to belong to an organization. They have a choice to go which masjid they want to go to, which mosque they want to go to. And they have access to the leadership that's not true in many Muslim countries. And because of that, problems are solved more quickly. Not as quickly as we may want, but more quickly. One example is, you know, in Toronto, you used to have Dr. Abdul Hakim Quick here. And he's now in South Africa. He did his PhD at the University of Toronto. He was one of the people who noticed that a lot of Muslim women were running into a problem in North America, which is that when their husband had a problem with them. I mean, this was if it was like, you know, this isn't the majority or by far the norm, but that small percentage of men who were abusive were not only abusive but were somehow very tyrannical towards their wives. One of the things they would do they wouldn't divorce them, but they would go away somewhere. They would go move back to Pakistan or move back to Egypt and just leave her. And she wasn't divorced, but her husband wasn't there either. And so this actually is, there's a term in the Quran called a mu'allaqa, which means the hanging woman. And it's addressed in the Quran that this woman whose husband has abandoned her without giving her a divorce, but he also doesn't live with her anymore. So when he noticed that, he went and he called a meeting of imams and of scholars, and they discussed it. They said, what can we do? Because we're not living in a Muslim country where this woman can go to a Muslim judge and get him to grant her a divorce. So they had meetings about it, they talked about it, they studied, and then they agreed that the imam of a mosque in this context, in this country, has the authority to grant a judicial divorce to that woman if it's proven that her husband has abandoned her. Now that was a great thing, and it was a very brave thing for them to do, because many people said, you know, you don't have that authority, you don't have that power. But they were able to argue it and get support from scholars in other parts of the Muslim world that they did have the authority to do it. So they solved that problem. And Abdul-Hakim Quick wrote a very good paper on this. Also, Muslim scholars have been dealing with problems in the marriage contract. So, for example, how sometimes couples come here from other countries, they were married in a certain context, then they move to North America, live here for a certain time, 10 years, 20 years. The husband divorces his wife and says, well, you wrote in the marriage contract that, you know, I give you a gift of 1,000 rupees, right? It's like $50, and that's all you get, so I don't have to pay you any alimony or any divorce settlement. Now, if you looked in a very narrow way at Islamic law, you'd say, well, that's right, it's a contract. Whatever they agree in the contract is what's effective. But again, the Muslim scholars, the Fiqh Council, which is the council of Muslim legal scholars in North America, examined this very deeply, and they said, no, there is proof in the Sharia, in fact in the Quran, for an additional gift to be given to the woman called the Mut'a, and that the woman has a right to this, and she has a right also to be compensated. If she's left this way, she has a right to be compensated for all the years of work that she did for her husband in many other areas that she's not required to do. So the scholars have solved this. Also with issues like domestic violence, which many imams of mosques became very shocked at the levels in this country. But, you know, domestic violence tends to increase under certain situations. One is a situation of stress, and the other is a situation of isolation. And what happens with many immigrants is they come here, it's a very stressful situation for the family, financially, emotionally, in other ways. And also, the woman is moving away from her family, from her familiar context, and is isolated from the people who would normally provide the social pressure to keep her husband treating her better. So that the increase was very shocking to many imams of mosques, and they didn't know how to deal with it. And we have a lot of stories about, you know, for many times where they just simply turned away from it. Because traditionally the imam of a mosque in a Muslim country is a prayer leader or an interpreter of scripture, but does not have anything to do with family counseling. That's handled by the large extended family. But to their benefit, many of these imams realized that in North America, 70 to 80% of their job would be family counseling. That's just the reality. And many of them have gone out and got training in family counseling. ISNA and other organizations have sponsored domestic violence training seminars and have been doing that outreach to the leaders of communities to say that this is your responsibility. If you're a leader of a community, you have to be able to recognize domestic violence. You have to know how to report it and how to deal with it. So that, you know, we have to be I'm very optimistic about the development of this community and the ability to respond to real problems that are occurring. Finally, I can't even remember when I began, and I didn't put a stopwatch, but I'll keep going for a little while. Sorry if I'm tiring you out, but I know that this is supposed to go on until 9, and I think a lot of you are going to probably leave in the break period, so I'll just keep going for a little while. when it comes to, you know, the problem, so-called problem of Islamic law, whether it has to do with women or with others, I think the main issue that we really have to grapple with, and this is an area where Muslim scholars are really only starting to look at things in depth and with some sophistication, is the extent to which law should be used to ensure that society is, one, secure, and second, moral. And let me talk a little bit about these things. You know, you see, again, you're in Canada, so I'm not quite sure. I heard about Bill C-36, but I'm not quite sure of all the dynamics. The only time I ever read about Canada in the newspaper in the United States this year was the last week when every day this figure skating pair was on the front page of the newspaper. I was talking to my mother. I said, I never read the word Canada in the New York Times. And then, you know, all week they're talking about Canada. So it's like you're a different universe or something. So it's hard for me to follow the news unless I go on the Internet. But at least in the United States since September 11th, what's interesting is to see how a society that has defined itself as a society essentially created to provide an environment so that people could exercise their freedom has increasingly defined itself as a society that necessarily and primarily needs to be secure. And so the balance between freedom and security is shifting. And over and over and over we hear justifications about limits on freedom in order to make society more secure and safe. Because if a government cannot make a society secure, and if you aren't secure and safe, you obviously cannot exercise your freedoms. So that's something that every society, every political theory, every constitutional system needs to grapple with. And, you know, what we see in many Muslim societies is that there are many threats. And there have been many threats to them politically. We also see that materially they're very insecure. Their economies are very insecure and vulnerable. And because of many different kinds of insecurity, there have been limits on freedoms. And this does not mean that all these limits are justified, but it means that we have to understand that in any society there's a dynamic that engages, and it's not because people are necessarily anti-freedom or because they're necessarily tyrannical or they love tyranny or they have some kind of immature existential development so they can't embrace freedom. It's because there's often many factors in society that make people want to look first and foremost at security. The second area is morality. You know, any society has a debate about what is in the public interest and what is good for the people. Now, if we look at Canadian society, for example, we see that I believe that it's required to wear helmets if you ride a motorcycle in Ontario. Is that correct? Okay, if you tried to make that a law in Texas, you would never, ever be elected. That would be considered a fundamental violation of personal freedom. I mean, this is my body. This is my head. This is my life. How can you force me to put a hat on my head, a helmet on my head? That is something that in a place like Texas would be inconceivable. Yet in this society, in Ontario, we wouldn't even bat an eye. We don't feel it's oppressive because we've embraced the idea, it's a social norm now, that that is in our best interest and the government has a right to protect us and to ensure that if we are not taking care of ourselves, that the government will take care of us. Now, I think when it was first introduced in Ontario, there's probably a lot of debate, but now we've got used to it. Same thing with seatbelts. I mean, you know, you're forcing someone to do something on their body, in their own car, and why is that? Because we believe that there's that the interests of society are greater than the personal freedom of the individual, to the point where we will fine them. It's a crime not to do it. A small crime, but it is still a crime. So that the notion that society can restrict individual freedoms for the sake of a greater social good is not unheard of in Canadian society. Now, different societies have different ideas of what is harmful to the social structure. Different ideas, different societies have weighed different values differently. So, for example, here, maybe the reason why seatbelts are required more than anything is because the government the government pays for health care and it's too expensive. So cost, right, outweighs personal freedom. In other societies, you have similar concerns, but you have different costs. You have society bearing different kind of costs. So that when we are trying to compare Muslim societies with our society, with Canadian society or American society, we should try to find, first of all, what are structurally parallel ideas and concepts before we just rush in and say this thing is an inacceptable, unacceptable limit on personal freedom. Now, it doesn't mean that we can't debate. We can debate, and certainly in some areas there are limits that maybe seem very unreasonable. And there are some limits in some Muslim societies that seem unreasonable to me and unreasonable to the people in that society. But these things should be debated in a framework that's understandable to everyone and not exoticized to the point where it's so strange we can't even understand it. These are not strange concepts. These are concepts that exist in every society. Now, one of the areas that I believe that Muslims need to address most critically is the idea of potential harm, because I think this is where sometimes Muslim societies go overboard. And that is that if there's a risk of something prohibited happening or something harmful happening, that you try to block the means to that. There's a term in Islamic law called Sadd al-Dharaya, which means blocking the means. Now, that is, for example, what was done in Afghanistan to forbid girls from going to school. They said, if they go to school, when they're out on the street, someone may say something bad to them or look at them in a bad way or attack them or kidnap them. Or if women work in the government offices, then maybe some bureaucrat in the office will proposition them, and this will lead to them being taken advantage of sexually, and then this will lead to adultery, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's this chain, right, chain reaction. Now, part of the problem part of their mistake was that they didn't look at other risks, because there are always multiple risks involved. So that what about, you know, anyone who makes this kind of reasoning to the logical extreme has to reason the other way to the logical extreme. Okay, what are the possible harms that can come from banning girls from school? Well, you know, they won't learn to read. They won't be able to learn about their religion. They won't be able to teach their children. They won't be able to take care of their own health care needs. Society will be deprived of their intelligence and their perspective, etc., etc., etc. So then if you did a proper risk-benefit analysis, you would probably come out with the right solution. But to make sure that the proper risk-benefit analysis is done in any society, you have to make sure that you have people who can see, you know, people can see all the different perspectives there. So that if you have a bunch of people who are all demographically exactly the same age, the same gender, the same educational experience, they're probably going to see things more along the same line and miss, be blind to a whole bunch of other factors. So that's why the Quran requires Muslims to engage in consultation, shura, to make sure that you're including all the perspectives of society so that when you're looking at a situation factually, you know you're not missing a major, something that's very obvious to someone else. You know, someone else will say, we'll see this as an obvious problem, but you don't see it because that's not in your purview of life. So that's where we need to work harder. And when we're trying to, as Muslims in this country, when we're trying to be supportive of Muslims in other societies and cultures, we need to be supportive of all of those Muslims, men and women. We need to be supportive of all of them, men and women. Because the Quran says that the believing men and the believing women are close protectors of one another. They enjoin the good and they forbid the evil together. Which means that who is it who has the greatest duty to protect Muslim women from being harmed in the name of Islam by Muslim men? It's Muslim men, other Muslim men, who have the greatest duty. And that's where Muslim men have to step up, because Muslim women are doing it, but Muslim men need to continue to step up and say, you know what, I'm not being unsupportive if I say, you know, you're doing something harmful to your own Muslim women. In fact, the Prophet Muhammad said, help your brother, whether he's being oppressed or whether he's an oppressor. ظَالِمًا أَوْ مَذْلُومًا. Whether he's an oppressor or being oppressed. The Prophet's companion said, we know how to help someone who's being oppressed, but what about the oppressor? How do we help the oppressor? He said, stop him from committing his oppression. So that we have to realize that being supportive means helping people do the right thing. And if we do that, if we understand our religion that way, then many of these problems that we see in the Muslim world can be helped. And when we go and we do relief work in India or Pakistan or Sudan or Egypt or wherever we go with our aid organizations, and whenever we meet people, we will go with a perspective that we want to give all of the Muslims their rights, men and women, and we won't be shy to say the right thing because it's good for both of them. It's not good to let someone to continue doing the wrong thing. So thank you very much for your attention, and I know longer than I was supposed to, but maybe we'll see some of you after the break.